Welcome today to our interview series with Outstanding Professionals. I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and I'm conducting an exclusive interview with Gilad Meiri, CEO of Neera, a wireless serial entrepreneur and a top-ranking executive and authority in the Internet of Things and innovation. Now, Gilad, you have so many outstanding contributions having significant global impact, so thank you for sharing so much of your expertise and experiences with our audience.
My pleasure.
Okay, now in getting to the questions, can you provide an overview of the Internet of Things and its history?
Sure. So the Internet of Things is about connected hardware, which in other terms means pieces of hardware that can be identified, communicated, or engaged with one another or the cloud or through any type of device like a phone. IoT, or the Internet of Things, is a term that's been coined in 1999 by Kevin Ashton, but essentially machine-to-machine communication has been around from the 60s. Siemens was one of the first to use it in all kinds of processes, like manufacturing processes and supply chain. But with regards to what today is called the Internet of Things, I think the most recent developments, predominantly the smartphones and protocols like Bluetooth Low Energy and Zigbee, and most recently 6LoWPAN, have been the main drivers of innovation, allowing us, you know, people, consumers, to really enjoy this connected hardware phenomena.
Well, you know, it's interesting. Sometimes I hear this term that this Internet of Things is going to be the next sort of planetary nervous system. And it's going to have profound implications, especially when you marry that with research and deep learning and machine learning and so on. But you also talked about, you know, this idea of the smartphones and so on. So how do you see the wearable market evolving and its value to enterprises?
Well, the wearable market is sort of the first inflection point, especially when you deal with devices that serve people, consumers. It is experiencing three-digit growth in the past 2-3 years. And I see that people, or you feel that people believe in the value. So, you know, whether placing something on your wrist or something on your other type of real estate in your body to measure biosensory metrics is something that people appreciate. That said, the user experience is not really out there, and it's a well-known secret by now that people are buying these devices, but the consumption or the 4-month usage rate is decreasing rapidly. And so I think there is a lot of graduation that still needs to be done in this space. With regards to enterprise, so this is a consumer-oriented phenomenon, and to be honest, I'm very much focused around consumer when I deal with IoT. But you definitely see a corporate wellness program that have greatly benefited from the wearable trend. I live in California. Many of the companies here, they provide wearable tech to its employees and provide all kinds of incentives to engage in preventative behavior to reduce the health premiums.
You know, you talked about that your focus is on the consumer market in terms of, you know, the research you're doing and what your company is doing. But I guess on the enterprise, the consumer trends do impact greatly. For example, email was a consumer trend, which then heavily hit the enterprise, or I guess the mobile market is the same. And there's so many other examples where it appears in the consumer marketplace, I guess even social media, and then enterprise are forced to adopt it or to deal with it in some way, and ultimately they get value from it. So I guess the next question then gets into the consumer electronics market and how this will change enterprises.
Right, so consumer electronics is rolling portfolios a bit slower, especially because many of the consumer electronic devices out there are essentially issued by these giants, which care more about stability and the right type of experience than innovation and doing crazy stuff. Not, you know, differently from the wearable tech, which is predominantly controlled by, you know, smaller companies. So you see a slower rollout. One exception would be these hub strategies where you buy essentially a gateway into your home, similar to SmartThings, which might be just acquired by Samsung these days, not sure, Revolve, and many of the consumer electronics players who want to put something in your home that will essentially navigate all of the communication from other devices through it. And obviously the one who sort of controls or can listen to what's happening through the gateway, get exposed to a huge chunk of data. With regards to enterprise, here there are actually a lot of utilizations, potential utilization, especially around energy efficiency, so connected sockets and switches and lighting, obviously air conditioner, thermostat, sorry, and also control, management of devices, IT, vast opportunities to bring connectivity into the office and into the facilities.
And I guess also, you look at things like smart TVs or even these gaming devices, and I walk into companies and I find a Kinect device, and they're using that for company communications amongst countries and so on. So I always find it fascinating when these devices that were meant for other things are sort of intruding into the enterprise, and then they're finding value in it.
Right, definitely.
Now, you're also have been following the auto market, and so what do you see some of the advances there, for example, in the Internet of Things?
So the auto industry, I think, is one of the most exciting with regards to the Internet of Things. I think it makes so much sense for the automotive industry to adopt some of these technologies. That said, again, safety issues really make, the trade-off between safety and safety rollout and innovation. And so you see advances now happening mainly in the infotainment system, in telematics, and less about the stuff that Google trying to roll out, like independent driving experiences, et cetera, et cetera. It makes a lot of sense. I think what the most exciting thing with the automotive industry is that it makes a lot of sense for players to collaborate, as opposed to consumer electronics, where it's not really certain if collaboration will benefit all, and so they try to own the customers by themselves, own the ecosystem, create their own unique landscape. Automotive industries will greatly benefit by cars talking to one another, regardless of the make of the car. Think of the safety implications if a car from one brand can talk to a car from another brand. And so companies like, with regards to enterprise, huge benefits. Companies like Local Motion and the Zipcars of the world are greatly, have great promise towards fleet management. And I think a lot of interesting stories and implications come out from this the whole connected car industry. For example, I recently spoke to a journalist who drove in one of the Google automated car, self-driving car, which we see here, which is very cool to see here in the Silicon Valley. One of the most amusing question that arises: who gets the ticket if the driver if the car did something wrong, right? So the driver is not really responsible for the driving of the car; he just sits there. But who gets the ticket? He was actually present in one of these occurrences where a car did a wrong turn and got pulled over by the police, and now there's a big question: who gets the ticket? Is it Google or is it the driver?
So I guess there's going to be some interesting policy requirements surrounding all of these rapid changes.
Definitely, yeah.
Now, Gilad, you're an expert in this area, an authority, and you've been writing papers in this area. You have a company involved in this area. So what do you see as some of the other timelines and other areas of the Internet of Things for the future and where it's heading?
Well, I think there's a strange dynamics in the whole space because it seems like it's moving very, very fast. But then again, when you ask people, what is the core values? What does this deliver? People still stutter from time to time. And so this year or next year are definitely the years of the wearable tech. And even though it seems like so many companies are out there, the smartwatch phenomena is still not released, right? Google, Apple, HP, Qualcomm are all having their own smartwatch initiatives, but have not yet rolled out, very slowly. With regards to home appliances, consumer electronics, gardening, gaming, I think you're seeing the shelves being stocked pretty slowly, with projections coming out 15, 16, where you see vast portfolio, wide portfolios of connected hardware. And within the automotive industry, it is hard to say, because what is a smart car? Is a smart car a car with a smart infotainment system, or is a smart car a autonomous driving car? So, you know, some definition needs to be defined, but essentially, 2017 to 2022 is pretty much the stage where most of the cars being offered on the market will have a significant smart components to them. Outside of these three, you see rollouts in gaming and gardening and, you know, even pet control. But I don't see these as significant, like, movements. I think the next step that was going to be very significant will probably be healthcare. So today the wearable tech is avoiding anything regulatory, anything FDA-ish, and they call it wellness, which is essentially saying we'll track your metrics, but we will not be responsible for the results you see. I think once the FDA gets involved, then you'll see some amazing technologies coming out to deal with chronic disease, with third world or, you know, telemedicine, rural medicine, and this will be extremely exciting.
Yeah, I mean, I guess there's these major disruptive shifts, and that's going to have significant impact on society, business, education, and so on. And there's also this idea of robots, which has been around for a long time, but there's been rapid evolution. I was just sort of amazed at the DARPA challenge that happened last year in December and kind of this current state of those kinds of robots. So where do you see this heading in terms of the current state of robots, and how do robots fit into Internet of Things?
Yeah, so to be honest, I know less about robots just because of my consumer focus, and within consumer, robots play a different role. You have companies like iRobot that, you know, their most known product is the Roomba vacuum cleaner, but they also have some exciting projects around the robot that serve you in the home area. On the enterprise level, definitely the defense industries and the safety industries can benefit and do benefit. Also, devices that serve in the manufacturing processes. This is essentially where it all began, right? To make manufacturing processes much more controlled and measured. But other than that, to be honest, I'm not your guy.
You know, worldwide, there's so many advances in machine learning and deep learning, neural networks. You know, you have the European Union in their brain project. The U.S. has something similar. I see reports from Andrew Ng, who's recently been hired by Baidu to head up all of their research, but created the brain project within Google itself. And you see Microsoft Atom and sort of a project in deep learning and the impact it's going to have. So do you have any views on this and how it will impact business?
Oh, well, definitely. I mean, this is essentially where I, you know, my goal in life today, to deal with artificial intelligence and machine learning. I think When you talk about deep computing, contextual computing, artificial intelligence, however you want to call it, there is a very gradual rollout because a lot of risks are involved. It's one thing for me to set your thermostat and maybe make a mistake. You want it a bit colder and I make it a bit hotter. It's another thing for me to decide to turn on your dishwasher machine when you don't really want it, and then the user experience, which would be horrific, would have ramifications for the user and the device. And so I think the rollout is very gradual. People are toying still with the idea of having machines and devices act more responsive and adaptive rather than programmable, but a lot of promise, a lot of promise. There are different approaches in the market. There are approaches that deal around, you know, focus around how to make a device smarter. There are approaches that really deal with sites, so how to make a home or an office or a facility, understand the whole dynamic. And obviously the ones that we deal with around individuals, really understanding individuals, and then trying to teach the individual's devices about their next predictable moves to allow these devices to foresee, predict, again, respond, and not just react or be activated. I see a lot of potential, but again, I'm highly biased. But I think from personal experience, all major players in this space are experimenting, highly interested, and any major developments in this space will be probably adopted. Anything that can be validated will probably be adopted by whoever is relevant.
You know, I recently did an interview with Tom Mitchell, who heads up the machine learning area for Carnegie Mellon, and he talks about this thing called a never-ending language learner. And it's a machine learning system which is teaching itself to read the web. It's already learned probably by now, let's say, 200 million facts on its own, and they periodically have to make corrections in its sort of knowledge base as it's kind of picking up information and getting almost an intuitive sense of what these different things mean. And in our conversation, he talked about this project will probably result in something quite meaningful in 10 years, where maybe it will have the ability to read everything and understand everything on the web. And he has a joint project on the brain itself and finding out sort of the different neural patterns that occur when people think. And he's going to merge these two projects. And then there's his never-ending image learner, which Carnegie Mellon has, but also MIT is working on a similar program. And, of course, Microsoft has their Atom project, which is an object recognition sort of advance.
Yeah, we're building this Skynet of the future.
Yeah, so I guess because you're immersed in this, and this is your area of also of expertise, you know, there's this kind of idea of Kurzweil and the singularity where, you know, machines are essentially going to have equivalent or greater intelligence than us, and perhaps will merge in some way. What are your thoughts on that? Do you think it's just out of will never happen, or, you know?
Well, I think there's a difference between the philosophical notion of the singularity type philosophy and what's really practical, what will happen. I think practically you will see great advances. You will see devices that are able to really predict and have a deep understanding of you. In a sense, think of a world where you walk and the world reacts to you, rather than you walk and you start needing to, you know, pull all these switches and levers to make the world work for you. Now, from there to a singularity situation where machines have, you know, understanding the true intelligence, I think we are still not there. Definitely nothing commercialized and nothing being close to becoming commercialized. I am a believer in science. I'm not really sure that human component can step out of the equation for the next two decades. Who knows what will happen then, right? Think of two decades ago. No one could foresee that, so I can't see beyond that. But I think it's predominantly theoretical at this point, and I am more focused, obviously, on the pragmatic usages of intelligence, and I think there is a lot to do and a lot to benefit from.
You know, in your work and sort of the focus of your company, do you see a global strategy in that, or what is the nature of your global strategy?
In terms of IoT or in terms of machine learning?
Machine learning, IoT, and even of your own company.
Right. It's funny. I think with regards to IoT in general, I think it's quite berserk because it does not really follow disruptive cycles. You know, you see Google buying Nest for $3.2 billion, which typically comes after a while where companies, you know, validated their value propositions on one hand, but on the other hand, you ask people, you know, what's the value in the Internet of Things in your life? People don't know what the Internet of Things is, but more so, it's not really clear, you know, waking up and having my coffee maker make coffee is not really a value. Who cares, right? The true value, the true compelling value will come from healthcare and safety and deeper security in our lives. And that's not really there yet. I mean, it's coming, but it's not really there yet. So on the one hand, you have this sort of sense of evolved market and all the giants of technology, the Apples, the Googles, the Cisco, the HPs are all believers in the value IoT can deliver. And so they're investing vast amounts. You know, any supermarket today have an IoT strategy. But still, it's very much ambiguous what can be derived and where will this head. It's hard to forecast. I think there's a lot of confusion, but a lot of belief in the value, and so the behavior of these companies is actually very, it's fascinating to see, because they're taking risks and they're acting in this uncertain space for them, and good things are happening. Good things are resulting from that. Good devices, good products, good projects, sort of favorable risk behavior, as I would call it.
So where do you see it, though, let's say in other countries, let's say China, for example? You know, there's the World Bank indicating that in GDP, China, or at least in purchasing power parity GDP, China will now overtake the U.S. this year. And there's tremendous investment in science and technology. Do you think that China will become a leading force in this area, or are they already?
So, you know, generally when the Chinese government says it's going to do something, I tend to believe them just because they've proved themselves as great executioners. No pun intended. I think, so the Prime Minister of China a couple of years ago really, you know, stated the Internet of Things is a strategic goal for the Chinese government. And obviously manufacturing coming from China, but more so smart grids within China, I think within the smart grid evolution, you see China definitely leading the way, just because their ability to take a city and embed it with infrastructure fast is has proven to be better than many other countries, and so I do believe China will become a leader in the Internet of Things. They aspire to be. They stated, actually, China as a government is the number one investor in the Internet of Things space globally, and they've declared this is only going to get sort of worse or better, however you want to call it. They're only going to deploy more capital towards IoT. Yeah, really exciting things will come out of China, if you ask me.
Gilad, you're in a perfect position to kind of evaluate some of the best resources in the Internet of Things and sort of make recommendations. And in fact, I belong to an organization called the ACM, and we produce some things called tech packs. And the reason we produce it is because there's so much noise on the Internet. There's so much noise in terms of offerings out there that you want to curate that content and sort of provide that to your member base and so on. So let's kind of tapped into your genius in this area, and you've spent years sort of researching this, looking at what's relevant and what's not. What are the sort of top resources that you would recommend for people to look at for learning more about IoT?
Yeah, good question. I today, to be honest, I still use Twitter. I just follow influencers in the space, and I find that to be the most. So for me, I value knowing stuff real time. I don't know why. I just do. And so Twitter really fulfills that need. So I'm an addict to my curated Twitter list, essentially. You have blogs like Postscapes. We released a newsletter called IoT Tabloid. But these are relatively small initiatives. I'm a personal fan of, Gigaom. I think Gigaom, the publication, is giving popular articles, but still, I think, pretty much the first to talk about in the best way. Other than that, if you look at the academia, they're producing a lot of interest in UX and in robotics and in contextual computing, but this is taking it really to a level of, to a professional level. If you just want to make sure that you know what's happening, I would definitely create a curated list of influencers in Twitter and just follow that. I think that would be probably the best source.
So do you have sort of some recommended names outside of yourself in terms of following on Twitter?
So I'm a personal fan of Stacey Higginbotham, and I know I'm butchering her name. I just call her Giga Stacey because she's the head IoT reporter for GigaOM. So that's one name. The other names I can't remember off the top of my head, but I'd be happy to share with you my curated list on your website, and you can share it with whoever wants it.
Well, that's excellent, and it's there's nothing like having curated lists with all the information that's on there. So,
right.
Now, we're going to shift to some broader questions now because you have this amazing background, and it'd be interesting to get your insights based on your background. So can you describe your most significant and influential achievements and the practical outcomes seen today and then forecast it into the future?
So I actually come from hardware. For the past 5 years, I've essentially dealt with connected hardware, my company, we helped create devices either by providing them connectivity, and that was pretty tough, 5 years ago when everyone just wanted iPhone cases and Bluetooth headsets, to convince people that connectivity has value. But we were fortunate enough to be engaged in all kinds of projects, anywhere from electronic cigarettes that measure your consumption to molecular sensing around food quality. I've definitely learned this from the bottom up and have engaged with really exciting entrepreneurs and their ideas. In terms of what Nura, our recent company, is doing, it's fairly recent, it's a year and a half old. We've done some projects for LG and HP and have rolled our beta just now. So the great things are happening and will come definitely. I think that's it. Pretty much.
You're also a significant influencer and leader, and it'll be interesting if you could share maybe some of your leadership lessons that will help our audience in terms of their roles.
All right, so for me personally, I've always been in very early companies, and so I think that will bring expertise that is dedicated towards that environment. And so I will not flourish in a big corporate with all the politics that surround it, but rather in a small companies. I think there is a place to have professionalism when dealing with rapid growth, for example. Rapid growth is a very unique situation, right, as opposed to stagnant companies. And I think that requires we can talk for a whole hour about how to manage a company that's experiencing rapid growth, that multiplying its workforce every month, and the whole ramification and processes that needs to be embedded on the run. So I think this is something to be researched. And again, I'm not sure that's highly relevant to ICT execs. I think the second thing I would say is knowledge is key. And I say it's because for me, I'm never the smartest person in the room. And so I make it an effort and make it a point to be the most educated person in the room. So I do see, I invest a lot of my time understanding and thinking about what's happening in my little space and in the bigger industry. And so whenever I enter a room or talk to employees or talk to, you know, the investors and partners, I do feel that the fact that I know what's happening, I have a good opinion, an educated opinion about what's the ramification, what is the strategic ramification, what will likely be the next steps, I feel it greatly benefited me. And I think for this reason is why I really maintain our newsletter, the IoT Tabloid. For me, it's a great disciplinary tool for myself to make sure I'm on top of what's happening. And having been doing that, you know, why not share it with the world? And the last thing I would say, which is more of my managerial motto, and I say it to every employee that comes to Nura or to Spicebox, the previous company, I actually have this big sign on my desk saying, I'd rather be pushing back raging bulls than pushing forward lazy donkeys. And so, which basically means the type of people you want in your organization, the type of people you want to work with you, are the ones who will require you to say, hold on, we can't do that just yet. And it's easier said than done because these type of people, very unique, very individualistic, very entrepreneurial, all have their complex personalities, and to really bring them on, to really empower them, and it will greatly benefit your organization, but you need to know how to manage this dynamic.
That's interesting, managing those who are just sort of pulling at the reins, right, who just want to just go gangbusters. Do you have any one thought to help manage those who have that sort of spirit?
Yeah, I think... I think you genuinely need to want them because it's, as managers, the comfort zone we have is for people who, you know, understand the responsibility and execute it to the point where you don't need to worry about it. You just, you know, talk to me at the end when it's done. This is sort of the ideal, you know, person to work with. But these type of people, you want them and you need them to see beyond. You need them, in a sense, I really want them to badger me and be extremely passionate. And I think across the board, in every type of role that I've been working with, for example, I remember in the early days I've been working with a graphic designer, and I still work with her today, sporadically, but she was phenomenal. And every time it was a website, it's our website, and she was enabling us. And essentially, whenever we wanted to do something that she felt was wrong, she would really, you know, stand on her legs and say, this is wrong, this is not good, even though it was our website. And remember that after we used other graphic designers, which essentially did what we asked, I was very offended. You know, don't you care? Don't you really care about this this website or this deliverable that you don't really argue with us? Don't just do what we tell you to do. You know, stand up and stand up for your thoughts. And so I do think that the best advice would be for managers to truly be able to accept these personalities and welcome them. And again, it comes with a cost because these are people who are, you know, entrepreneurs have complex personalities, and they do want to conquer the world. They do want to make changes. Some people feel that continuous changes, continuous improvements, and, you know, the innovative frame of mind is disrupting their peaceful day-to-day life.
That's some good advice, right? To have diversity in the team and especially have those who are kind of leading in their thinking. But as you mentioned, there's a cost, and that cost is managing that energy and ensuring that it's directed to moving that organization forward. But I guess even managing the teams, because those kind of personalities sometimes can be hard for others who are used to being in the comfort zone.
Right.
Now,
I mean, I have, all my friends here, most of my friends, they work in corporate America, and fair enough, they have great positions, they impact definitely the organization in which they work, highly impactful, but I do think that, put one of these disruptive thought thinkers in a team, and it's going to sort of disrupt the dynamics of the team, and I think good teams will embrace that. And mediocre teams, let's call it, will want to go back to the status quo, then sort of the 9-to-5 status quo. And this is essentially why I would never fit in one of these big organizations.
Now, the next question is about people who inspire you. Can you name one or more who inspire you and why this is so?
Wow. Yeah, so many on a personal level, professional level. Let me think. I think, so Elon Musk, the Tesla, the SpaceX, I'm definitely a huge fan. I don't know why. I think he's sort of an anti-hero who's a hero. He's not as eloquent and, inspirational talker, like me, maybe others, but he is an extreme visionary, and the things he's accomplished and what goes on in his mind just astounds me. I'm really fascinated by great ideas, like vast ideas, world-changing ideas, and I think Elon Musk today is one of the heroes of this phenomenon. I would say Tim O'Reilly. From Riley Publishing, who has always been in the forefront of technology, sort of projected the Web 2.0 or the web in his literature, and now really is focused around human and machine interaction and what machines can really do for us. So specifically in the Internet of Things, he's a great influencer. Who else? Can go back to Ayn Rand, who I'm one of her fans, who really, I think, age 16, gave me the power to believe in what I want to believe and to not conform. I kind of think that many entrepreneurs are, I find that many entrepreneurs have been greatly influenced by her books.
Perhaps this next question is maybe a little bit difficult because it seems like you're very eclectic and you're always embracing agility and change and looking at innovation. But I'm going to ask it anyways. And, what surprises you?
Well, it's a great question. What surprises me? So I'm continuously surprised. I think I'm a fan of innovation and innovators. I am awed by what's called the maker movement. I don't know if you're familiar with this phrase, but I think innovation has the accessibility. It became much more accessible to many people, and so today people they just do, right? You have curious people, people who like to learn, who have a great skill set, and they just you go to the garage in their home and they do stuff. And today with technology is really enabling them to do it. You have, the Arduinos, the Raspberry Pis, the yo-yos, which are, these essentially rapid prototyping tools. And if you go to the maker movement, if you go to talk to these makers, I'm continuously awed by the ingenuity, and humility of these people. Just do it. There's no there's no commercial, necessarily commercial idea behind it. I recently met this engineer from Twitter who I think I can talk about it. He was very upfront about it. What he did was he created a spectrometer for your toilet seat. So whenever you essentially go to the bathroom, go to the toilet, your urine is being analyzed on the go. So think about you're actually essentially doing 5-6 urine tests a day, and he really believed that by tracking that, you can understand trends in our health, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, he just thought about it, and he knows about, you know, he understands spectrometry, and he, you know, teamed up with a doctor, and he just did it on his spare time. I think I'm awed by these type of people, really. I'm not that type of person, to be honest, and I'm extremely respectful for them.
You know, that's kind of fascinating. I'm just thinking that perhaps then this whole idea of diagnosis through your eyes, and, you know, there's this sort of merging of electronics and wearable contacts, or even Google Glass, and then monitoring your health through your eyes, I guess, because it's sort of a window into your health.
Definitely.
And your ideas kind of trigger this idea or this concept of, you know, the sort of the phases of development is sort of like concept research and development to transfer production, deployment, usage, and then the types of innovation from, you know, it could be product or service, but it could be process too, or it could be in the manufacturing area or business model or organizational model, and it kind of forms a matrix. And a lot of people think that innovation is only in product and services, but not realizing it can be in so many other different areas and in all the different in the different aspects of the phases of R&D or development. So, you know, it's a fascinating topic. Now, and you trigger all of this because you have such an eclectic sort of background. Do you see or have any recommendations of improvements in policy that should happen here in North America and perhaps internationally?
Yeah, definitely. I think the unfortunate truth is that policy and regulatory are typically not fast enough to really adjust. They always adjust years later after the need has risen. But that said, without great policies, some of the greatest achievements technologically would never have been, you know, just the WWW or the Wi-Fi or the Bluetooth standards. So I do believe that whenever you can go around policy and have commercial solutions to needs, that would be preferable. That said, some things you just have to have policies and regulatory powers to navigate and control the right activities, the right solutions. I think that within IoT specifically, security is a huge pain point. Right, just the fact that so today when I have my computer, you know, I have hackers can hack into my computer and, you know, hack into my bank account and create all kinds of financial transactions, and that's bad. But it's not nearly as bad as when some hacker hack into my smart home and control it, or smart utility company, or smart grid, and essentially shut down the city. And so there is a lot of fear, which is very justified, around security, and I think companies are not doing enough, and they're not doing enough because they don't have to. And so one big chunk of policy that must arise, and quicker rather than later, is to define the security measures that must be in place when dealing with connected hardware. Another pain point is privacy. It's one thing for Google to know every move I do on the web. It's another thing now to open it up to my life, to my sensory activity, to my home. And, you know, Google bought Nest. Some people say now I have an eye. Google is an eye on my wall because Nest has motion sensor. And Google just brought Dropcam, which is an IP camera. And now, you know, Google has access to the streaming of my IP camera inside my house. And so a lot of privacy issues are arising. And even though we sort of given up as consumers the battle of privacy over the web, I think many people are not ready to give up their, you know, metrics, their sensory metrics on their body and their telematics on their car, et cetera, et cetera. And I think the balance here needs to shift. People need to own their data, control their data, and understand why they're giving away privacy and be able to manage it. Today you cannot manage it and it's not transparent to you. Google and others, they know so much about you and you don't even have a clue. And I think the third thing, which is really required policy, is standardization. You know, today machines don't talk to one another. You have all these abstraction solutions that essentially say, okay, you are device type A and you're device type B, I will help you communicate. But I think in the future, devices will be able to communicate with one another from the get-go. And you have all kinds of initiatives, a huge political thing. Qualcomm with AllJoin and Cisco and AT&T have joined hands together, and some European challenges, challengers. But at the end of the day, it's going to be a political decision, a consortium where competitors sit around the table and decide what is the protocol to be used with machine-to-machine communication. And that will bring about great solutions, great interoperable solutions. So a long answer to your short question.
This next question, it could be difficult in the sense that, you know, this whole idea of a profession, and it's of interest to my audience, and that is, you know, you have medicine, law, and engineering, and they have things like demonstrated professional development, adherence to the code of ethics, personal responsibility, public accountability, quality assurance, and recognized credentials. Do you feel that computing should be a recognized profession on par with these others that I've mentioned?
Well, I know the sort of the desired answer for this would be yes, but I actually think no. I think it's a question of what type of decisions one can take, and I think most software engineers or developers are executing on a code on a project, and the decision maker is typically not the developer, but rather someone in management and product. And so I think, you know, the risk for unethical behavior or irresponsible deliverable does not lie with computing, with developers. It lies with the management. And so the answer to your question is I don't think you should give the same scrutiny to accountants and lawyers as for developers.
Now you travel the world, you speak, you do interviews, you engage with experts in different areas. So from all of this work that you do, do you have any one or more stories you want to share? Maybe something amusing or amazing, unexpected?
Good thing. Yeah, so there's a thing I do when I talk. I wanna prove to the world that personalized computing is happening today. When I say that, so my goal is obviously in the Internet of Things is to have your home react to you and to your partner and to your son and daughter, or to you in the evening, to you in the morning, differently, because it really understands your needs, your goals, who you are, etc. And I try to convince people that this is actually happening today already. And so what I do is I ask the audience, whenever I sit in a panel, or sometimes when I sit in a panel, to all take out their mobile phones and put a word in Google. It can be any word in the Google search. Definitely if you put words like buy, I want to buy something, right? So buy. And then check out their neighbor's phone and see that the results that each and every one of us is getting, even though we're at the same time at the same place, are vastly different, because Google creates a profile around us, and when we say the word buy, Google wants to maximize the results for us. And, you know, I want to buy whatever, hardware tools, and you want to buy cars, right? So you'll see different results. And I always find that some people in the audience just have no idea that Google is doing this on, you know, that performing this, you know, logical exercise on us. And I just completely amazed, and to the point where sometimes I cannot, I need to give them a few minutes to sort of relax. and because they have to continue to talk about it, and they're just baffled by the fact that Google knows what they want to buy and what coffee they like to drink if they just enter the word coffee, et cetera, et cetera. So I always find this amusing whenever I'm in a panel to find this one or two persons that have never even thought it's possible for Google to do that, and now it's sort of it's an aha moment for them.
You know, that's a great story. You know, I speak a lot, and do you mind if I borrow that sort of audience interaction? I'll attribute it to you. It's a great way of engagement.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. And again, it comes really to prove my point that, you know, you experience seamless personalized experience. You have that in your life. You just don't know it. And it's much easier for me to then, you know, tell the audience, why can't your house do that for you, right? Why can't your car do that for you, for your wife, or your, you know, husband, et cetera, et cetera. It helps me drive the point very, very, you know, intuitively.
Now, the next question is very open-ended in the sense that I'm asking you to choose the topic area, and then what do you see as maybe one or more top challenges facing us today, and do you have any kind of solution you want to propose?
So again, I'm highly geared toward the Internet of Things. I think over there you have multiple challenges. I think the main challenge is the fact that there is huge discrepancies between demand and supply. So this is today it's very much a supply-driven phenomenon, right? No one is standing and yelling, I need this, but rather the companies, they bet on what they think will benefit the user, right? So the whole wrist phenomenon, you know, put something on your wrist that will measure your activity. And many of these devices are rolled out because execs in these companies, they thought it, you know, people will benefit, and sometimes they win, sometimes they lose. I mean, a connected coffee maker has lost because someone thought that it might win in the future, but so far there are a few solutions like that, and people are not spending the $100+ to, you know, spare themselves of the 5 feet walk towards the kitchen and pressing on the coffee maker. But thermostat have won big time, right? And so I think there was a huge discrepancy, and again, the dynamics are fascinating, but the demand side is moving wildly, while the supply side, the manufacturers, the solution providers, they're, you know, venturing into unknown lands, while the demand side is still fast, but still gradually adopting these solutions and just opening themselves to the notion that a car can be more than a car, and a door lock can understand that, you know, your babysitter has arrived to the back door and has opened itself automatically. It still seems Star Trek-y to many consumers, but it's far from being Star Trek-y to the manufacturers. I mean, for them, it's real. So I think this is a fascinating dynamics. There is no solution. Somehow, either the supply side will need to wait, or the demand side will need to adopt, you know, be educated and adopt faster. I don't know what will happen, which will come first. There is the consequence of that is that, especially in the early stage level, is that if you bring solutions, if you create solutions that are too early, you're at the risk to be exhausted, you know, financially, resource-wise, before your solution is becoming relevant. I would say this is one thing. The other thing is the difference between UX and value. So I think today people want to start more and more believe in values that a connected hardware can bring to the world, but still the user experience is very much 1.0. And I think it's time for the user experience to not be navigated by engineers, but rather by UX professionals. And we need to start appreciating form factors. People don't want to put ugly things on their body. They want beautiful, you know, design devices. And it's time for the experience to go above and beyond the numbers and graphs and be more holistic and personalized. And I believe that the market is not moving fast enough in that direction. I think it's still about launching a product, putting it out there, and then worry about a good user experience. I think this is the mindset currently. It's changing, but too slow in my eyes.
So those are some great sort of viewpoints you provided. Now, we're on our last question, and this one is about sort of turning the tables in this interview. You know, I've asked you a series of questions, and there's some things I haven't asked you about. For example, your backpacking in Southeast Asia, or your yeah. service with the military, or the fact that you have written cooking books.
Yes.
But I'm going to turn the tables and say, you know, we've discussed a lot of areas. If you were doing this interview, what questions would you have asked, and then what would be your answers?
Yeah, challenging questions. I would, I would deal with the future, or the enablers for the future. What will the future bring, and what needs to happen for the future for this to be brought? To be delivered. And I think there are a few barriers that need to be removed. I talked about FDA, but I think it's worth reemphasizing that with regards to wearable tech, once FDA regulation and security improvement happens, you're really going to see magic. I mean, I really believe that this is the time where medicine can greatly benefit, and I think this is worth a whole different podcast. and I'm here very much biased, but the only reason I'm biased is because I'm a deep, deep believer, true believer in the value of intelligence. And so how will the future look like? I believe the future, at least the consumer future, will be very much adaptive learning to our needs. And if I would like to paint a picture of the future, I think that, we call it the halo effect, but people would walk and the world around them will react to the point where you will not need to use switches. You will have greater safety, right? So you just stepped outside of home, and the home will remind you that your oven behind you is still on. You will be notified when the temperature in your parents' house has risen to abnormal level and might be a fire happening. Security, right? The whole notion of armed and unarmed homes will be dissolved by a home that really understands the patterns of the home and is now able to tell you, I know you did not arm the system, but there's someone in your backyard after 9:30 p.m., and this never happened in the last 200 days. Maybe it's worth checking out. I think this type, and this is only, you know, a small benefit. You can go much deeper. But I do believe, and I do want to paint a very bright picture for the future with regards to real compelling value around safety and security and energy management. I think the pace in which the industry is moving is highly accelerated, and within 3 to 5 years, it's going to be relevant to the masses. It's not going to be the smart homes owner right here in the Silicon Valley, you know, highly tech savvy, whatever, but rather this is going to be accessible to all and intuitive enough that people will understand the value and sort of pay the cost of installation and understanding to derive that value. So I'm not sure I really answer your question, but I would love to talk about that.
Well, you know, you just gave us some additional great foods for thought, and it could generate a whole slew of podcasts on some of the things that you've introduced. You know, Gilad, it's just an amazing experience today talking with you, and I know you're got a demanding schedule, so thank you for coming in and sharing your experiences with your audience.
Thank you very much. My pleasure.
I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and this concludes our exclusive interview with Gilad Meiri, CEO of Neera, a wireless serial entrepreneur and a top-ranking executive and authority in the Internet of Things and innovation.